Today is really anchored in an article that Rav Yoel Ben Nun wrote many, many years ago, and it kind of is premised on the following question. At work, it's kind of premised on the following question, which is, where is Chanukah in Tanakh? Now, the question can be answered one of several ways. The first way to answer the question is, it's a ridiculous question because Chanukah is an event that happened in the post-biblical period, so it's not in Tanakh, and that's true. On the other hand, you can say there is a model for Chanukah that's in Tanakh, which is the Chanukat HaMizbeach, which is what we read, the laying that we have, so that's also true. You could also say that there are models for the Chanukah victory in Tanakh. Perhaps you could argue that some of Sefer Shoftim, which is an uprising against a powerful army, might be something of a model for Chanukah and Tanakh. Alternatively, you could see the dedication of the Beit HaMikdash, including the 8-day dedication that takes place as for Divrei Hayamim, as being a model for Chanukah, and that may be the reason why Chanukah is 8 days, as in Tanakh. But I'm going to look at it from a different perspective. And part of what I'm going to ask us to imagine is what was going on in the minds of the actors in the Hanukkah story when they both acted in their valorous way, but also when they created a commemoration, whatever the commemoration was at the time of a festival at that time. And to do so, we have to look back and ask the following question. And again, this is anchored based on Rav Ben Nun's article, but it's a lot of other things included. What is the Beit HaMikdash? Because Chanukah is about the Beit HaMikdash, about the liberation of the Beit HaMikdash, the purification, the rededication. What is the Beit HaMikdash? So there's a lot of answers you could give to it. I'm going to give one which will sort of include a lot of different things, which is, it is a central location that represents the sovereignty and centrality of Am Yisrael in Eretz Yisrael, in which Kadosh Baruch Hu's name becomes sanctified throughout the world. The reason I threw in that thing about sovereignty is because there was no Mikdash until there was a government with a capital established and secure borders. And that was the order in which it happened. There was a Mishkan, to be sure, from the beginning. But a Mikdash was only built after David had successfully broadened and secured the borders, and then there was a dynasty because David died and Shlomo took over, then there was a Mikdash built. So that's what a Mikdash sort of depends on. Now, a Mikdash, after 400 some odd years, was destroyed. It was destroyed for whatever reasons. We're not going into that now. But the Mikdash, then, there was a great desire among some people to rebuild the Mikdash, what we refer to as the Second Temple, but to rebuild the Mikdash. And so rebuilding the Mikdash, you could think, is as simple as clearing out the rubble and refinishing the building and reinaugurating Avodah. But based on what I suggested as sort of the definition of the Mikdash being a place that represents the sovereign, independent government of Israel, with its central place of worship, sanctifying God's name and being a place of teaching and prayer for the entire world, somehow puts it into a little bit of a different light, which means that it is deficient if it's missing any of those components. And so therefore, when Cyrus in the year 539 defeated the Babylonians, and then publicly said, anybody who wants to go back and rebuild, I'm giving you materials and all of that, that was a partial but not a total rebuilding, because you're rebuilding under the thumb of the Persians. And the best proof of that is that when we started rebuilding in the year 536 and had laid the foundation and set up the Mizbeach, immediately our neighbors, the Samaritans, who wanted to participate, said, we'd like to join you. And we said, butt out. And then they badmouthed us to the Persian government. And the Persian government immediately called a halt. And for 20 years, there was nothing going on. For 20 years, there was a foundation and a Mizbeach sitting out there, not being used and not being finished. So it really wasn't up to us. And then 20 years later, when, and we're going to see a little bit of that, when we lobbied Daryavish, the third Persian emperor, to allow us to finish the rebuilding, then that took place. It means it was all under their control. It was very nice of them, but on the other hand, it's not our control. So there's something significantly missing. And Chazal say that in different ways when they talk about the tremendous miracles that happened in the first bayit that didn't happen in the second bayit, and how the second bayit was deficient relative to the first bayit in all of those ways. Right? So that means that from a particular perspective, when the Mikdash was rebuilt, people could look around and say, yeah, but... And that's reflected in the famous story in Ezra, Perek Gimel, at the end of the Perek, where it says that when they first set up the Mizbeach and brought Korbanot, all of the young people were yelling and screaming out of joy, and all of the old people were crying because they remembered what the first Mikdash was like. And you couldn't distinguish one sound from the other. But the idea is that this rebuilding was bittersweet, right? Because it didn't really include all of that. Yeah, Jason.
When did they start calling it Bayit HaShani?
In post Bayit times.
Post second.
Post, yeah. Yeah. Anyways, there's no reason to ever refer to the Beit HaMikdash that's standing as Bayit Sheni, because that implies that there's some sort of a sequence going on. And
well, right? You would imagine now if we built another one, we would probably call it the Third Temple.
Yeah, but that's because we had a second. If we had a Beit HaMikdash that was up and it was destroyed and now you rebuilt it, you would refer to it as the Beit HaMikdash. Right? Because the assumption is we rebuilt it and now we're finished. It's be forever. Right? So now that we've been trained, what?
Now we wouldn't have that.
No, I mean, Herod didn't call it Beit Shlishi. Right? He tore it down and rebuilt it. He didn't call it Beit Shlishi. It was Beit HaMikdash. Right. So I want to take you now back to that period. In Ezra Perek Hei, which is pre-Ezra, meaning Ezra is telling the story history beforehand. Remember, Ezra made Aliyah around the year 450, 455 BCE, and this is events that happened about 60 years earlier, in about 518 BCE. We have the following line. I have it in English too. Nabi Chagai Neviyahu Zechariah Bar Ido Neviyaya Al Yehudai Divi Yehud Yerushalayim Bishum Eloi Yisrael Aleihon. You see it in English. And this, by the way, is in Aramaic because much of Sefer Ezra were letters written to the Persian government. And so that was in the court language of Aramaic. Beidayin Kamu Zubavel Bar Shaltiel Vishor Bar Yitzadak Vishorid Mivne Beit Eloh Adi Vishalayim Vimhon Neviyaya Adi Eloha Misadi Nohon, which means in both these two psukim, it indicates that there were these two prophets, Chagai and Zechariah, who were supporting, who were giving support and helping the building of the Mikdash, or the rebuilding of the Mikdash. The question is, how were they helping? What were they doing? So you could say, on the one hand, they were sitting there cheering everybody on and providing pickaxes and whatever, but there seems to be more than that. So we'll take a look at them, and we're going to find that both Chagai and Zechariah, and Chagai is all of two chapters, and this is the part of Zechariah that we're dealing with is the first six chapters of Zechariah, relatively small books, and by small chapters too. We're going to find that the messages that they broadcast are messages that carry with them, on the one hand, support and promise for this rebuilding right now, but also something of a glimpse to the future. All right, so, and Chagai in Perek Bet, it's all in Perek Bet, now, by the way, in prophetic pronouncements, you rarely, not never, but you rarely have a date. You're not told what date this pronouncement was. In Yirmiyahu, for instance, often you will find out what year it was to which king, because that's a part of the story. But you rarely get the date. There's a couple places in Yechezkel, notably the 10th of Tevet, when there's a particular date stressed. But rarely are dates stressed. I don't think anywhere in Yeshayahu it shows up. And so here, Besim V'ar Ba'alat She'i, the 24th day of the 9th month, which, by the way, is Kislev. So they, now this is, of course, 350 years before Hanukkah ever happened, so it's not a relevant date at this point. And he tells him this prophecy, and the prophecy is about the Mikdash. And then, and then, at a later point in that prophecy, Chagai says, pay close attention to this date, which again is something that is absolutely unprecedented in Tanachic, with the exception of that note about the 10th of Tevet in Yechezkel Chav Dalet. But otherwise, there's never a situation where it says, pay close attention to this date, and notice what it says. Just before we put one rock next to another, Yenechal Hashem, Simul Lavavchem, in Yomaz of Amal, in Yomaz Swimbar, Baal Achim, in Yomaz Sheyusad, Yechal Adonai Simul Lavavchem. There's this constant stress, pay attention to the date, pay attention to the date. The 24th is just before we're going to put one rock next to another, 24th of Kislev. Very strange. And then Chagai has his fourth and final Nevuah. His first Nevuah was in Elul, the next one was in Tishrei, and now he has two on the same date. So there's a second Nevuah on the 24th of Kislev. Now what's he told? Emoral Zubavel Pachat Yudah Lemor. Go tell Zubavel. Now Zubavel, remember there's two leaders, Zubavel and Yehoshua. Zubavel is the political leader, and Yehoshua is the kohen. Right, so go tell Zerubbabel, Ani mar isha to shamayim v'taretz. I'm going to shake up heaven and earth. V'hafachti kisei mamlechot v'ishmati chozek mamlechot ha-goyim. I'm going to shake up, I'm going to turn over the thrones, and I'm going to destroy the strength of the kingdoms. Rashi says this is referring to the wars of the Hashmonaim. V'hafachti merkava v'rochveha v'yardu susim v'rochveha mi'ish b'cher avachiv. I'm going to turn over the chariots and its riders, which gives them an image of the Greek armies. I'm going to take you and you will be my, I will seal you. It's an interesting word. And that's the end of Haggai. That's the end of Haggai. So it says, as if Haggai is saying, pay close attention to this date, the 24th of Kislev. Pay close attention, because it's the day just before we're going to put one rock next to another. In Echal Hashem. And notice that his focal point is towards Zerubbabel, the political leader. Now keep that in mind because we're going to come back to it. Now, you are a Jew listening to this Nevuah. And you continue and you end up working on the building, and the building is dedicated on the third day of Adar in 515 BCE. Okay. And you've still got in the back of your mind that there's this Nevuah about the 24th of Kislev just before, the 24th of Kislev just before. 350 years later, in the year 167 BCE, the Greeks enter the temple as part of Antiochus' campaign. And they dafka pick the 25th of Kislev as the date on which they're going to put an idol of Zeus on the Mizbeach and start all of their other idolatrous stuff in the Mikdash. Now, why did they pick that date? There's three possible answers. One is they picked the date because that's the first date they came in. It just happened when they got there. The second possible reason is that they picked that date because there was something in their calendar that motivated that date. And the third is there might have been something in our calendar. So something in their calendar is we actually know about. The 25th of the winter month in the Greek calendar was a fire festival called Saturnalia. And it was based on the old Persian festival called Mithras, and it later gave birth to the Roman festival of Natalis. These are all on the 25th of the winter month, and they were seen as being right around the solstice, and they had to do with the cycle of the seasons, etc. So it could be that the Greeks were saying, on our holiday, we're going to put this on. It's also possible that they heard the Jews walking around talking about, on the 24th of Kislev is the day just before God's going to turn over the kingdoms, and God is going to restore Zerubbabel and all of this, and it could be that, like, as an in-your-face thing, that's the day that we're going to show you our power. Could be. One thing that we do know is that 3 years later, when the Hashmonaim entered the Mikdash and cleaned it out, it was significantly before the 25th of Kislev. It may have been as early as a month earlier, as the 27th of Marcheshvan, that they came in. So why did they wait till the 20th? So they tell us, in 2 Maccabees, they tell us, we waited until the 25th of Kislev to put the to dedicate the altar because we wanted to do it on the exact same day that 3 years earlier they had defiled the Mizbeach. It was another in your face. Which means, by the way, that they may be reacting to a Greek festival. You know, we're all bothered that Purim, if you think about it, is on a day that was decreed by a pagan god. Because Haman did a lottery and it came out to the 13th of Adar, and so we celebrate. But Hanukkah also may be something that was based on a Goyish calendar. Could be. The other possibility is that we're turning around saying, we've been walking around for 350 years with the Nevuah that we're still waiting to see fulfilled, which is The 25th of Kislev is the day we're going to put one stone next to another. Now, when do you put one stone next to another in the Mikdash? It's not building the temple. It's the Mizbeach. And that's exactly what they did.
When was the prophecy?
What? 518 B.C.
Why did you say 400 years?
No, I didn't. I said 350 years.
And what was the 350 from?
350 from there or later is Hanukkah. This prophecy is in 518 B.C. Hanukkah happened 350 years later.
Oh, but it's very Irish.
Right? Which means that you may make the argument that the story of Hanukkah, the story itself, but that the particular date of Hanukkah and the event of Hanukkah and everything is something that's actually anchored in a much earlier prophecy that just took a long time to unfold. Because what was the real dedication of the Mikdash? When they had an independent Mikdash under Jewish sovereignty, which is the first time here since Zedekiah, and really since Yechoniah. The first time since what we call the first Beit HaMikdash that we had independent and sovereign Jews standing over.
That's the 350?
Right, that's 350 years. Correct.
So we never learned it that way, the prophecy of
I don't know.
When you think about it in school, they always talk about Jamila
territory
victory. They always talk about.
I can't defend why something wasn't taught, and I don't know. So this is the first piece of the puzzle, but it's only one piece of the puzzle because remember what it says in Ezra, that Haggai and Zechariah, promote this idea of building, and promote this support the building. Okay, so let's look at Zechariah. Zechariah. Very, very different than Haggai. Haggai, as you notice, is two prakim. Haggai, if you notice, has his main address be to Zerubbabel, who's the political leader. And at the very end, it's only to Zerubbabel, and it's about a political and military upheaval. Right? etc. Zechariah is a very different story. Zechariah, the first six chapters of Zechariah, are essentially happening one night on the 24th day of Shvat, 2 months later than this. And he has seven visions in one night. And Zechariah, and you can sort of tell you're getting to the end of the period of prophecy because Zechariah doesn't understand the visions. The visions are murky, the visions are very symbolic, and he doesn't understand the visions, and therefore he has a vision guide who's called Hamalach HaDoverbi. The Malach who speaks to me. So he sees something, and he turns to the Malach and says, what is this? And the Malach interprets it, which is, if you think about it, is kind of a weak level of prophecy, right? In any case, I'm going to show you what these visions are. All right, the first vision, I'm not show you, but I'm showing the text. And for verses 3 through 9 are the seven visions, just in order, right? Notice, we're already in the Persian era, so they're giving us the Goyish names, Shvat, along with the Jewish names, which is the number. Right, in that month, so he had this prophecy. What was it? Ra'iti halayla. I had a vision. Like, what did I see? V'nei ish rochev al sus adom. There's a man riding on a red horse. V'hu amed ben adasim. He's standing in between the myrtle trees, asher b'mtzula in a valley, v'acharav susim adumim sukim ulvanim. So he says there's red, striped, and white horses behind him. And now, in the rest of that, we have to fill in, the rest of that prophecy, he says to the man, where are you going? He says, we are traveling throughout the land and coming to Yerushalayim. Okay? Second vision. And then, what?
Is this the Makor for Kanikis?
Makor for, yes. It's a Drabanan. Now, then in the middle, by the way, in between each of these prophecies, Zechariah has a comment, he has a prayer, right? Ad matai lo toachem et Yehuda v'Yerushalayim? How come the whole world is quiet and Yerushalayim is in pain, and how come you don't have compassion for them? Second vision, I see four metal horns, and I see four smiths, you and two more, right? For smiths who are working on the horns. And he says, what are these horns? And the answer given is, these are the horns that came and brutally destroyed Yehuda. Okay? What is this vision? It's all very, very strange. Okay? Third vision. I look up and I see in the vision a man with a measuring rope. measuring rock, surveyor's rope. Right, in Anata Olech, where are you going? Vimelai Lamurit Yerushalayim, the road, Kamar Chbal V'chamor Ka. I'm going to measure Yerushalayim, see how big Yerushalayim is. And that's when he has the famous prophecy, Prozot Teshev Yerushalayim. Yerushalayim will ultimately be an unwalled city. It's going to have so many people, they won't be able to fit. Right? Beautiful, beautiful, beautiful. Right? Fourth Nivuah, and this is the one we're all familiar with. And we have our state symbol based on this Nivuah. Vimelai Ma'ataru Ev Omar Ra'iti. Menorat Zahav Kula. What do I see? An entirely golden lamp. V'gula Rosha. There's a bowl on top of it. V'shiva Nerote Haleha. There's seven cups. Shiva v'shiva Mutzakot v'Nerot Asher Al Rosha. They're all soldered in. U'shnayim Zeitim Aleha. By the way, there's two olive branches in front of them. Okay. Echad Mina Gula v'Echad Al Smola. All right. Two olive branches. Very strange. By the way, this is where it gets really strange. Zechariah, who's having this nevuah, in the nevuah, goes to sleep. And he's woken up. And the malach says, what do you see? And he says, I see this. He says, what is it? I don't know what it is. Yes, you do know what it is. It's a weird conversation. Lo yadati, ataken yadata. So what is it? And what's the answer to this nevuah? Ko amar Adonai, lo b'chayil, v'lo b'choach, Ki'im Baruchi Amar Adonai Tzvaot. Which translated properly in the biblical idiom means not only with might and not only with power, but also with my spirit will this happen. Right? Ki'im Baruchi doesn't mean not and only this, but rather not only this, but also this. Right? So it's spirit and power. Interesting. What's the fifth vision? This is where it starts to back up. The fifth vision is, I see a scroll flying scrolls. Right? Rocky. I see a scroll flying out of Yerushalayim, and we're given the dimensions of the scroll. Out of Yerushalayim. What's the sixth vision? He says, I see a basket. I'll just summarize it. And there's a woman in the basket, and in the basket there's a piece of lead, and the lead is in her mouth, and she's leaving, and I see two women flying, and they have wings like a stork, and they're flying, and they're holding the basket in the air. So what is this? This is the wickedness leaving Yerushalayim. And then there's a seventh vision. This final vision is, I see two copper mountains, and in between the two copper mountains, there's four chariots. And the four chariots are led by Susim Adumim, Susim Shchorim, Susim Levanim, Susim Brudim Amutzim. Sounds familiar. This is a very bizarre thing. And that's the end of his visions. Afterwards, we have this whole famous scene in which three messengers come from Babel to Zechariah and say, should we continue fasting? Tisha B'Av. And his whole answer, which is basically, you don't even understand the question. It's a non-question. And it goes on. But the first six parakim are basically this, right here. These nevuot interspersed with tefillot. So Rabbi Nun took a look at this and came up with the following solution. Turn the page. He said, if you look at the Nevuot, they are chiastic. The first vision is red and white and colored horses. The last vision is red, white, black, and colored horses leading chariots out of Yerushalayim. The first is leading them into Yerushalayim. What's the second vision? Horns and smiths preparing horns that are going to come in and attack Yerushalayim, the ones who did. And in the second to last vision, you have a basket taking the wickedness with lead in its mouth, more metal, outside of Yerushalayim. In the third vision, you have somebody going to Yerushalayim with a measuring piece to measure Yerushalayim. In the fifth vision, you have somebody leaving Yerushalayim with a Megillah, which is measured, 20 by 20. So the fact that 1 and 7, 2 and 6, 3 and 5 are parallel is pretty obvious. What's the middle vision? The middle vision is the menorah. Now look what you end up with. And you notice the first three are all coming into Yerushalayim, the next three are all leaving Yerushalayim. And in the middle you've got the menorah. And so you now have seven visions, which make up a menorah. Look at the picture. make up a menorah. And in the center of it is Yerushalayim. Now, what was his message in that middle nevuah? Lo v'chayah v'lo v'chayah ki'im beruchi. Meaning, it's not only power, it's also spirit. And remember, what was Haggai's prophecy? Haggai's prophecy was about military overturning the enemy. It was about a political upheaval. And this is about a spiritual upheaval. This is spiritual upheaval.
When was this one?
This is the same time. Same 2 months later.
The prophecy.
Yeah. 518 BC.
Which is first?
Haggai, then Zechariah. But notice that his message here is one of saying it's not just going to be power, it's also going to be spirit, which may have been a secret motivation for Chazal switching the focus of Hanukkah from a military victory to the Ner, Beis Pach Hashem, etc. May have been the motivation for that. But in any case, that's where we end up. So now, if you recall, the last piece is that on the menorah, what's described here, you have the menorah with the gold and everything else, and you have two olive branches. What are the two olive branches? It says, Eila Shnei B'nei Yitzhar. These are the two olive branches. The two olive branches seem to be saying, Chayil and Ruchi. In other words, Chagai and Zechariah. So now you are a Jew walking around in the year 516. You say, okay, we're rebuilding this Mikdash, and we've been given these nevuot. One nevuah about overturning the chariots of the enemies, another one about building a menorah. And I haven't seen it happen. The menorah we have is a cheap thing. The enemies are still in charge, right? And by the way, what date did Haggai continue to stress? 24th of Kislev is the day before it's going to happen. 24th of Kislev is the day before it's going to happen. 350 years later, a whole new government has come in, the Greeks, and we've been shifted between the Ptolemaeans, not so bad, and the Seleucids, pretty awful, and now we're under the Seleucids and think it was terrible. It's a whole different world, three times over. We've gone through several Persian kings, and then the Greeks, and among the Greeks, about four switches, but the nevuah doesn't disappear. And now, all these years later, we're suddenly standing there and see the ultimate dedication of the Beit HaMikdash is to make the Mikdash under sovereign Jewish rule. This is the real dedication. And it happens exactly as Haggai intimated, but don't forget Zechariah's message, Lo v'chayah v'lo v'chayah ki'im beruchi. So therefore, the broader vision of Hanukkah is not just one of a military conquest, but also one of a spiritual regeneration or rejuvenation, which is, of course, what Chazal infused into the holiday. I have to remember that when Hanukkah when the miracle first happened, the first thing they did was, that year, what did they do? They took the Arba Minim and they did Hakafot around the Mizbeach, and they said Halal, and they made an eight-day Sukkot, basically. Like Pesach Sheni, so Sukkot of Kislev. That's what they called it. Subsequently, they would have a military parade. And subsequently, the Hashmonaim, the big battlers against the Yevanim, became more Greek than the Yevanim. Became worse than the Mitnevnim. They massacred the Chachamim. It was terrible. So what do Chazal do after the destruction of the second Beit HaMikdash? What do Chazal do with this holiday? They take a page out of Zechariah and they say, okay, what we really need to do is to emphasize and focus not on the military power, but on the spiritual power. And that's the Hanukkah that we have today. So when you ask, where is Hanukkah in Tanakh? You have four answers. Answer one is, it's not there. It didn't happen yet. Answer two, you have Chanukat HaMizbeach, which is our lightning, because that's sort of the model. Answer three, you've got the Shoftim and all sorts of other rebellions, which is sort of a model and inspiration for them. And then number four is, it may be that Chanukah is actually based on an ancient nevuah that for 350 years the Jews were walking around with, and now finally they had an opportunity to experience. So,